When at last he broke the kiss, Ralph held her close still, and his stiff, dark moustache tickled her ear as he whispered, "The minute I get you into the tent, Katie, my love, we will give that new mattress of yours a stiff test." She flushed a richer tone of pink and tried to slap his cheek, but the blow was light and loving. Ralph chuckled, then reached down and picked Jonathan up by one arm and dropped him into the gelding's croup behind the saddle. The boy wrapped his arms around Ralph's waist and demanded in a high, piping voice, "Did you find gold, Papa?"
"A ton."
"Did you shoot any lions?"
"100.
"Did you kill any Matabele?"
"The season's closed."
Ralph laughed and ruffled his son's dark, thick curls. But Cathy scolded quickly. "That's a wicked thing to ask your father, you bloodthirsty little pagan." Louise followed the younger woman and the child at a more sedate pace, stepping lightly and lithely in the thick dust of the wagon road. Her hair was drawn back from her broad forehead and hung down her back to the level of her waist in a thick braid. It emphasized the high arches of her cheekbones. Her eyes had changed colour again. It always fascinated Zuga to see the shifts of her mood reflected in those huge, slanted eyes. Now they were a lighter, softer blue, the colour of happiness. She stopped at the horse's head, and Zuga stepped down from the stirrup and lifted the hat from his head, studying her gravely for a moment before he spoke. "Even in such a short time I had forgotten how truly beautiful you are," he said. "It was not a short time," she contradicted him. "Every hour I am away from you is an eternity." It was an elaborate camp, for this was Cathy and Ralph's home. They owned no other, but like gypsies, moved to where the pickings were richest. There were four wagons outspanned under the tall, arched wild fig trees on the bank of the river above the ford. The tents were of a new snowy canvas, one of which, set a little apart, served for ablution. This contained a galvanized iron bath in which one could stretch out full length. There was a servant whose sole duty was to tend the 40-gallon drum on the fire behind the tent and to deliver unlimited quantities of hot water day and night. Another smaller tent beyond held a commode whose seat Cathy had hand-painted with cupids and bouquets of roses, and beside the commode she had placed the ultimate luxury, scented sheets of soft coloured paper in a sandalwood box. There were horsehair mattresses on each cot, comfortable canvas chairs to sit on, and a long trestle table to eat off under the fly of the open-sided dining tent. There were canvas coolers for the champagne and lemonade bottles, food safes screened with insect-proof gauze, and 30 servants. Servants to cut wood and tend fires, servants to wash and iron so that the women could change their clothing daily, others to make the beds and sweep up every fallen leaf from the bare ground between the tents, and then sprinkle it with water to lay the dust, one to wait exclusively upon Master Jonathan, to feed him and bath him and ride him on a shoulder or sing to him when he grew petulant. Servants to cook the food and to wait upon the table. Servants to light the lanterns and lace up the flies of the tents at nightfall, and even one to empty the bucket of the hand-painted commode whenever the little bell tinkled. Ralph rode in through the gate of the high thorn bush stockade that surrounded the entire camp to protect it from the nocturnal visits of the lion prides. Cathy was still on the saddle in front of him, and his son up behind. He looked upon the camp with satisfaction and squeezed Cathy's waist. "By God, it's good to be home. A hot bath and you can scrub my back, Katie." He broke off and exclaimed with surprise, "Damn it, woman! You might have warned me."
"You never gave me a chance," she protested.
Parked at the end of the row of wagons was a closed coach, a vehicle with sprung wheels, the windows fitted with teak shutters that could be raised against the heat. The body of the coach was painted a cool and delightful green under the dust and dried mud of hard travel. The doors were picked out in gold leaf, and the high wheels piped with the same gold. The interior was finished in glossy green leather with gold tassels on the curtains. There were fitted leather and brass steamer trunks strapped to the roof rack, and beyond the coach in Ralph's kraal of Thornbush, the big white mules, all carefully matched for colour and size, were feeding on the bundles of fresh grass that Ralph's servants had cut along the river bank.
"How did himself find us?" Ralph demanded, as he let Cathy down to the ground. He did not have to ask who the visitor was. This magnificent equipage was famous across the continent.
"We are camped only a mile from the main road up from the south," Cathy pointed out tartly. "He could hardly miss us."
"And he has his whole gang with him by the looks of it," Ralph muttered. There were 2 dozen blood horses in the kraal with the white mules.
"All the king's horses and all the king's men," Cathy agreed.
And at that moment Zuga hurried in through the gate with Louise on his arm. He was as excited by their visitor as Ralph was irritated.
"Louise tells me that he's broken his journey, especially to talk to me."
"You'd better not keep him waiting then, Papa," Ralph grinned sardonically.
It was strange how all men, even the aloof and cool-headed Major Zuga Ballantyne, came under the spell that their visitor wove. Ralph prided himself that he alone was able to resist it, although at times it required a conscious effort.
Zuga was striding eagerly down the row of wagons towards the inner stockade, with Louise skipping to keep up with him. Ralph dawdled deliberately, admiring the remarkable animals that Jonathan had moulded from river clay and now paraded for his approbation.
"Beautiful hippos, John John."
"Not hippo?"
"Oh, I see. The horns fell off, did they?"
"Well, then, they are the most beautiful, fattest, hornless kudu that I have ever seen."
Cathy tugged at his arm at last. "You know he wants to speak to you also, Ralph," she urged. And Ralph swung Jonathan up onto his shoulder, took Cathy on his other arm, for he knew that such a display of domesticity would irritate the man they were going to meet, and sauntered into the inner stockade of the camp. The canvas sides of the dining marquee had been rolled up to allow the cool afternoon breeze to blow through it, and there were 6 men seated at the long trestle table. In the centre of the group was a hulking figure, dressed in an ill-fitting jacket of expensive English cloth that was closed to the top button. The knot of his necktie had slipped, and the colours of Oriel College were dulled with the dust of the long road up from the Diamond City of Kimberley. Even Ralph, whose feelings for this ungainly giant of a man were ambivalent, hostility mixed with a grudging admiration, was shocked by the changes that a few short years had wrought on him. The meaty features seemed to have sagged from the raw bones of his face. His colour was high and unhealthy. He was barely 40 years of age, yet his moustache and sideburns had faded from ruddy blonde to dull silver, and he looked 15 years older. Only the pale blue eyes retained their force and mystic visionary glitter.
"Well, how are you, Ralph?"
His voice was high and clear, incongruous in such a big body.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Rhodes," Ralph replied,
and despite himself let his son slip from his shoulder and lowered him gently to the ground. Instantly the child darted away.
"How is my railway progressing, while you are out here enjoying yourself?"
"Ahead of schedule and below budget,"
Ralph countered the barely veiled rebuke, and with a small effort broke the hypnotic gaze of those blue eyes and glanced at the men who flanked Mr. Rhodes. On his right was the great man's shadow, small, narrow-shouldered, and as neatly dressed as his master was untidy. He had the prim but nondescript features of a schoolmaster, and receding wispy hair, but keen and acquisitive eyes that gave the lie to the rest of it.
"Jamieson?"
Ralph nodded coolly at him, using neither Dr. Leander Starr Jamieson's title nor the more familiar and affectionate Dr. Jim.
"Young Ballantyne,"
Jamieson slightly emphasised the diminutive and gave it a faintly derogatory twist. From the very first, their hostility had been mutual and instinctive. From Rhodes's left rose a younger man with straight back and broad shoulders, an open, handsome face and a friendly smile which showed big, even white teeth.
"Hello, Ralph,"
His handshake was firm and dry, his Kentucky accent easy and pleasant.
"Harry, I was speaking of you this very morning."
Ralph's pleasure was obvious,
and he glanced at Zuga.
"Papa, this is Harry Mello, the best mining engineer in Africa." Zuga nodded. "We have been introduced." And father and son exchanged a glance of understanding. This young American was the one that Ralph had chosen to develop and operate the Harkness mine. It meant little to Ralph that Harry Mello, like most of the bright young bachelors of special promise in southern Africa, already worked for Cecil John Rhodes. Ralph intended to find the bait that would tempt him away.
"We must talk later, Harry," he murmured,
and turned to another young man seated at the end of the table.
"Jordan," he exclaimed. "By God, it's good to see you."
The two brothers met and embraced, and Ralph made no effort to hide his affection. But then everybody loved Jordan. They loved him not only for his golden beauty and gentle manner, but also for his many talents and for the warmth and real concern that he extended to all about him.
"Oh, Ralph, I have so much to ask and so much to tell you." Jordan's delight was as intense as Ralph's.
"Later, Jordan,"
Mr. Rhodes broke in querulously. He did not like to be interrupted, and he waved Jordan back to his seat. Jordan went instantly. He had been Mr. Rhodes's private secretary since he was 19 years of age, and obedience to his master's least whim was part of his nature by now. Rhodes glanced at Cathy and Louise.
"Ladies, I'm sure you'll find our discourse tedious, and you have urgent chores to attend to, I am certain."
Cathy glanced up at her husband and saw Ralph's quick annoyance at the artless presumption with which Mr. Rhodes had taken over his camp and all within it. Surreptitiously, Cathy squeezed his hand to calm him and felt Ralph relax slightly. There was a limit to even Ralph's defiance. He might not be in Rhodes's employ, but the railway contract and 100 cartage routes depended upon this man. Then Cathy looked across at Louise and saw that she was as piqued by the dismissal. There was a blue spark in her eyes and a faint heat under the fine freckles on her cheeks, but her voice was level and cool as she replied for both Cathy and herself,
"Of course you were correct, Mr. Rhodes. Will you please excuse us?"
It was well known that Mr. Rhodes was uncomfortable in the presence of females. He employed no female servants, would not allow a painting nor statue of a woman to decorate his ornate mansion at Crutescure in the Cape of Good Hope. He would not even employ a married man in a position close to his person, and immediately discharged even the most trusted employee who took the unforgivable plunge into matrimony.
"You cannot dance to a woman's whims and serve me at the same time," he would explain as he fired an offender.
Now Rhodes beckoned Ralph.
"Sit here where I can see you," he commanded,
and immediately turned back to Zuga and began rapping out questions. His questions cut like the lash of a stockwhip, but the attention with which he listened to the replies was evidence of the high regard he had for Zuga Ballantyne. Their relationship went back many years, to the early days of the diamond diggings at Colesberg Kopje, which had since been renamed Kimberley, after the colonial secretary who accepted it into Her Majesty's dominions. On those diggings, Zuga had once worked claims which had yielded up the fabulous Ballantyne diamond. But now Rhodes owned those claims, as he owned every single claim on the fields. Since then, Rhodes had employed Zuga as his personal agent at the kraal of Lobengula, king of the Matabele, for he spoke the language with colloquial fluency. When Dr. Jamieson had led his flying column in that swift and victorious strike against the king, Zuga had ridden with him as one of his field officers and had been the first man into the burning kraal of Gubuluwayo after the king had fled. After Lobengula's death, Rhodes had appointed Zuga custodian of enemy property, and Zuga had been responsible for rounding up the captured herds of Matabele cattle and redistributing them as booty to the company and to Jamieson's volunteers. Once Zuga had completed that task, Rhodes would have appointed him chief native commissioner to deal with the Ndunas of the Matabele,
But Zuga had preferred to retire to his estates at King's Lynn with his new bride, and had let the job go to General Mungo St. John. However, Zuga was still on the board of the British South Africa Company, and Rhodes trusted him as he did few other men.
"Matabele land is booming, Mr. Rhodes," Zuga reported. "You will find Bulawayo is almost a city already, with its own school and hospital. There are already more than 600 white women and children in Matabele land, a sure sign that your settlers are here to stay at last. All the land grants have been taken up, and many of the farms are already being worked. The bloodstock from the Cape is taking to the local conditions and breeding well with the captured Matabele cattle."
"And what about the minerals, Ballantyne?"
"Over 10,000 claims have been registered, and I have seen some very rich crushings."
Zuga hesitated, glanced at Ralph, and when he nodded, turned back to Rhodes.
"Within the last few days, my son and I have rediscovered and pegged the ancient workings I first stumbled on in the 60s.
"The Harkness mine?"
Rhodes nodded heavily, and even Ralph was impressed by the range and grasp of his mind.
"I remember your original description in Hunter's Odyssey. Did you sample the reef?"
In reply, Zuga placed a dozen lumps of quartz upon the table in front of him, and the raw gold glistened so that the men around the table craned forward in rapt fascination.